Welcome to Biceps and Banter with expert trainer Brandon Crowe. Hold on to your dumbbells and get ready for this conversational style podcast focused on interesting everyday dribble with tasty tidbits of health-related information sprinkled in. Enjoy.
All right. Welcome to Biceps and Banter. I'm sitting here with Nicholas Keegan, and Nicholas is an author, former competitive figure skater, former competitive professional skater, did Disney on Ice and all that good stuff, and we're going to get into pretty awesome conversation. We had a good time. We went in some crazy directions talking about his path, his past, and how he became a competitive athlete, and I talk about my experience figure skating as well, so I think you're going to have a great time listening to that. So enjoy the podcast.
So my manager just got two big boxes of books for the launch party.
Oh, tell me,
So it's like our first batch of like it being delivered in big bulk.
So where is this going to be stored? Like at your house?
Yeah, he's got them right now, but because the bookstores want them to put on the shelf. So we had two big shipments sent.
That's cool.
40 bucks. We started with just 40. I've sent him another order to send us another 40.
Now, remind me after we finish this. I've got to get you to sign mine. You're going to sign this for me after we're done.
I've never held one.
Really?
Holy smoke. Take a picture this moment.
Yeah?
Take a picture. Yeah. This is like a big moment. I don't know why I've not ordered one before.
What?
Yeah. Everyone has a copy
of me. You haven't even held your own book yet.
No.
Have you seen the pictures?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's been buying them. I don't know why.
I mean, have you seen, like, a digital copy?
Yeah. I had to approve everything.
Oh, okay.
Everything was pretty much, I put everything together. But this is the first time I physically, something from the printer that I didn't print off my own computer. And I'm so glad this turned out properly. The colors and everything. Like,
You chose everything to
do. Everything's put together. I put everything together. But it's so different when you're putting it, like even the cover, like I did all of that, like I laid everything out for the designer
because
I didn't like what they were doing. Did say that.
Okay.
I'm not editing it. They know it. I like literally cut and pasted. I went to Walmart with these images.
No
and
way.
Cut and pasted and put this whole thing together and sent them a copy and said, this is what I want it to look like. Yeah. Like the weirdest thing about this is being this moment where we're sitting in right now, holding this book for the first time. When you put this whole thing together, I mean, it's such a massive project between the book editor, all the people that are brought into the picture.
Yeah.
You know, the book editor and the illustrator and the, you know, you have a project manager that manages them.
Yeah.
But everything's obviously done digitally through Photoshop and, you know, as far as the book cover and the layout and the, you know, the spine of it and all those little details. But when it's on a computer screen, it looks super fancy, but you don't know how it's going to print.
Yeah.
You know?
And are you happy with how it printed?
Yeah. When I was writing the book, because the first novel is very autobiographical to my own life experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things, especially in the first four chapters, that it's completely me.
Mm.
Completely me. But I flipped it into the part of a girl.
Right.
Because that way women will relate to the lead character.
Right. So you said first four chapters. So if I was to read the first four chapters, I haven't yet. Sorry, I just got this on Friday.
Yeah, you just write. Yeah.
So if I was to read the first four chapters,
Everything that happened to me.
Really, 100%.
Pretty much.
And no like embellishment.
I'm trying to think. Not really. No, I mean everything's written in fiction. I've put everything in fiction to make sure I don't get sued.
Yeah.
And had lawyers look over it. Like.
Yeah.
I was super. Very paranoid and very careful about that.
Here's my question then. If people read this,
and
everybody like, everybody around will know the story,
right?
Could they then take it to a judge and be like,
no?
I guess because it's not their name.
It's not their name and it's not their likeness. And there's nothing like I really put I put a good 3 months into just developing the characters to make sure that they were 100%
fiction. 100%
fiction,
but the story is real.
But the story is the story. Because this book takes place over the first 6 months of her career, her first time on the road. So I've packed a lot of different stories of what happened to many, many different people and packed them all into one six-month period.
Absolutely. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So the girl in the story,
Like, the first four chapters are 100% me.
100% you.
Like, so I'll just give, like, yeah, in the first, I think it's the second chapter, the end of the second chapter, half of them almost get fired because they went skinny dipping in the hotel pool.
And that happened.
Yeah.
Oh.
I almost got fired my first week on tour.
Oh, nice.
Because I was working for, I'm not going to say what company, yeah, it's a big company.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, its lead character has ears.
Okay, yeah, okay, I got you. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's, yeah, yeah, you know, I was working for Disney on Ice, and we all just got drunk, yeah, and decided to go skinny dipping in the hotel pool. And we got caught by security cameras. And the entire management found it, and we were all in a lot of trouble.
That's hilarious. How old were you?
I was 22.
22. And the girl in the story, is she older or younger?
She's younger. I put her at 18.
18. Okay. Yeah. But similar timeline, like just starting your figure skating.
Just starting, and you show up and you get into something
that... Your professional career as like a figure skater. This is, you made it.
Yeah.
And this is one of... Is it one of your first gigs?
Yeah.
Like big gigs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I don't know. There's a lot of things with this book that... when I wrote this book, like, I didn't want to just write my own little autobiography. I didn't, you know, like, that's not why I wrote it. A big reason I wrote the book is, I don't know how to explain it, but to say that when you're living that life as an artist, there is this sense that it's not a real job. And there's a lot of depression and embarrassment that comes along with being in a career path that other people don't take seriously.
Mm.
And that right. was something that I don't know how to explain, but it's something that within the first chapter, it was explained to me on the plane. Yeah. And I made sure that the lead character, it was explained to her the second she got there, that you're gonna realize when you go home.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Oh, right. Oh.
No one will take you seriously right. in life.
Even though you were a professional
and you're making money.
And you're making money and you're doing Disney on Ice and everything.
Yeah.
People think you're doing just...
They're just like, you need
it's
to grow
a hobby.
Up.
It's
you
a
need
hobby.
To grow up. When I wrote this and I was actually talking about this, discussing this with a friend, I was like, I got to put this conversation in the very beginning of the book because it's so important.
Mm.
Because it's such a huge... weird obstacle emotionally and psychologically to get past to be an entertainer. Not caring what people think outside of it all, because you can tell they judge you and they put you down,
yeah.
even though they don't put you down and they're not criticizing you in a negative way. They're trying to help you. They think they're trying to save you by saying, when are you going to get a real job? Or, their intentions are good. Because they want you to land on your feet, and they know that this is not a forever thing. You know, this job that you have, or they think that you're capable of more,
yeah.
or you should be striving for more.
And this is just a temporary thing.
It's some kind of temporary thing, or you're somehow lost. You're in a weird place. You're just lost, and they don't get that. No, this is like a real thing, and I'm not lost. This is who I am.
And this is your passion, and this is what you
and this is the career path, and this is. And I realized when I had this conversation, because the friend that I had this with was much older, was retired, and was a CEO type, you know, very, very successful. And we were having this conversation. She said to me, you have no idea how many people feel the exact same way about their job because of the fact that they don't have the big title or the corner office.
Oh, yeah.
There's this idea that if you're in the corporate world and you don't have that corner office.
Right.
You know, with the big Christmas bonus and the big everything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have your own parking spot in front of the building. You haven't made it. And you somehow, you think less of yourself.
Right.
Like it's not real enough.
Yeah.
There was an experience actually when I was working on the cruise ships for Royal Caribbean. And Royal Caribbean hires phenomenal entertainers, like such talent. And one of some passenger, because you mingle with passengers. And one of the passengers came up to one of the singers, who's phenomenal. I mean, the girl is amazing. And, you know, this is what she does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she works cruise ships and makes really good money. She's like one of the highest paid on the cruise ship line.
Can you name drop?
Yeah, Angela Callow. She's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. If you look her up, websites, wow, that girl.
Yeah.
She is phenomenal. She's,
Angela Cowell.
Callow.
Yeah. I have to check that out.
She's phenomenal. Like a vocal talent that's just like... unbelievable. Anyway, someone came up to her and was like, you know, this is a really good platform for you. And she was being, the passenger was being very complimentary. like, you're fantastic, you're amazing. You know, kind of like, what are you doing here? That's what the pastor was basically trying to say is. She was like insulted. She's like, this is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
I love my job and this is what I do for a living. Well, and, you know?
Like, even when you look at the Olympic athletes, people see that as amateur hour. Yep. Like, they're amateurs unless you're like a Michael Phelps or unless you're like a whatever, you know, top of the top. Unless you're absolutely winning gold medals.
Yes.
Everybody underneath the gold medal, the silver medal winner goes home and the mom's like, when are you going to get a real job? This Olympic thing doesn't look like it's working out for you. You didn't get that gold.
Yeah.
It's time to go work at Staples.
It's really interesting how our society is structured. It's not even, I don't even think how much money you make. It's success is built on so many, like the way we perceive success. Fame in any industry is so much bigger than how much money you make or, you know, doesn't matter what kind of business you're in. If you Google that person's name into the Google search engine, if things pop up, it's like, wow, you're successful.
Yes. Right.
Meanwhile, that could mean nothing.
Yeah.
Anyone can create a website.
Well,
anyone can make themselves look, you know, but in the world of any kind of profession, it's what pops up there when people.
It's true. Well, I mean, even for me, like, I will pop up on Google searches, and sometimes if people type in Toronto personal trainer, I may show up at some point in the Google search. But I'm not Tony Horton of P90X, so I have not made it yet.
Right.
Not until I'm Tony Horton.
You can see that, though.
Right.
You can
see it's the same thing.
But it's interesting how, you know, because I'm all over the internet from the TV shows that I've done, because I did a lot of TV shows in Europe, so there's, like, thousands of YouTube videos and all these different things.
But you're not Elvis Stoico yet.
No.
Yeah, so
I'm not that guy.
So you have not made it. You're not Elvis Stoico.
I'm not on that level. But for somebody
that
doesn't understand, that goes on there and sees that, they're like, oh, my God. And it's, but it's, like, whatever. I don't know. And you know, it's interesting because you come home from tour all the time, and when you come home, there's this weird in the real world, you know, you pay your rent or your mortgage, and you have a home, and you have a car, and you maybe have pets, and you have all these things that kind of anchor you to reality.
Mm-hmm.
But as an entertainer, whether you're struggling on the road, you know, you're just floating, or you're super famous, there's not really a lot anchoring you.
Hmm.
You know? I mean, there are huge rock stars, movie stars. They've got the big mansions, but their life is in floating mode.
Yes.
You know? And I think a lot of the reason they turn to drugs and they slide into that they're not able to connect to the real world because their job doesn't give them that, doesn't plant the roots. The only way for them to make money is to be out there doing it out there. And I don't know. I think psychologically that kind of plays on you after a while.
Oh, for sure.
Because you look at everybody else who has a job where there's like this one location they go to every day and everything is branched out from there. The rest of their life branches out from there.
Yes.
And has to be connected to that.
Yes.
Whereas when you're an entertainer, you're just floating because that job floats and moves.
Yeah. You're
on the road, or you're whether you're a musician and you're on the road, or you're an actor and you're on location, and you're in one place for 4 months.
Yeah,
you know, you're living in a place, and they give you accommodations.
They
give you a beautiful condo
live
in, or a home, or a hotel. You know, they give you places to live that are really, really nice.
Yeah,
but it's not your place. I don't know. I really wanted that to tie in because I struggled with that. In the beginning, I shouldn't say in the beginning, my entire career, I struggled with that feeling of not having a real job. And then when I gave up the industry and I found my way out of it, which was a hard thing to do because establishing a job, because now my full-time job, I mean, I coach mostly.
Yeah.
That's where I make, that's how I finance my life is coaching.
Yes.
And it's a whole different career path that's tied into skating, but, it took a long time to build that clientele and to get that life going.
Yeah.
And once I got that life going, everyone I spoke to from the show world, all of a sudden we were on a different page.
Hmm.
And it was really, really hard to not put them down, which is interesting. Because I wanted to help them get to where I was. Because I could see that they were struggling.
Okay, I got you.
I could see that they were in a place of, I want to get out of here too.
So that raises a good question. Why did you leave the professional lifestyle to go coach?
I couldn't do it anymore.
What couldn't you do?
lived that life floating.
Oh, okay. You wanted more stability.
I wanted to feel like a normal person.
Right.
Because on the road, it's exciting and it's an adventure. Right. And it's all these amazing, exciting things.
Yeah.
You know, you're
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
The best way I could explain living the life of a touring entertainer is you're living, you in that course of a career, whatever it is, 10 years, whatever, you will live 10 lifetimes in the span most people live one. You will experience more than the average person, because you're going to go all over the world.
Yes.
And you're going to see things and do things and be a part of things. And things happen around you, circumstances, and weird shit that you could never have anticipated. You know, just really bizarre stuff. Just all of a sudden you're in the middle of, and you've got to find your way through it or get out of there. And you're just tied into all these weird, because you're placed in weird situations in different parts of the world where it's a different culture and you don't know what the hell you're doing or why are you there, or you get stuck somewhere. You're in a city you don't know. You don't know what, you know, I mean, I remember being in Germany and I call it Cologne, Germany, but I think it's called Köln, Germany, if pronounced correctly. It's a major city in Germany. And I was renting a room in this little old lady's place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure she was convinced the war was still on because she wanted the shutters kept closed so neighbors wouldn't know I was there. It was maybe she felt the neighbors would look down on her, that she was renting out rooms to entertainers or skaters or people. Maybe she's in her own mind, right. She thought that was inappropriate.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Or people might, that her her neighbors might judge her.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it was weird. And the thing is, she spoke no English. So there was that language barrier of her basically showing us, you keep these drapes closed.
Yeah.
No one, it's very strange. Anyway, so I took the tram into the city because she was out of the side of the city. And I really didn't understand. I really took too many chances. And I thought I could find my way back, and I got into the city and I got turned around and I didn't know where I lived. I couldn't get out of the city. What direction? I couldn't find my way back to the subway that I got onto.
Yeah.
Where I got off that intersection, I couldn't find it.
Okay.
So I was completely turned around in the city. I don't know, north, south. And I spent 6 hours wandering the streets of Cologne, just lost. Completely. How do I get out of here? How do I get back to where I live?
Yeah.
What do I do? And this is before, I didn't have a cell phone. Cell phones were new at the time. This was like 2002. So people had cell phones, but.
Yeah, I didn't.
I don't know if I had. I'm sure. No, I didn't have one. I wandered the streets for 6 hours. My feet were killing and it became dusk and then the sun went down and I'm lost in the middle of this big city and I have absolutely no idea where I live.
Is that when you started doubting this whole career? Because
I was like, what the hell have I just done? I just took a tram out of the city, you know, into the city, and I'm overwhelmed and I'm lost. And so I went into this is when internet cafes existed.
Cafes.
And I went to an internet cafe and I sent a mass email out. I guess I was just, I don't know, just desperation. Desperation when I sent a mass email saying, I'm lost in the city and blah, blah, blah. I don't know what to do. And I sent it to everybody.
Yeah. Somebody came and saved you.
No, nobody came and saved me. I'm in the city and it was like an email home to Canada.
Oh.
Everybody.
Oh, you're sending emails back home.
I don't know what I was doing. I was lost and I was overwhelmed and I didn't know what to do. And I needed someone to talk to. But anyways, I just... After wandering the streets, and I was like, okay, maybe I'll just get a hotel in the city and spend the night here. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I'm playing at a major stadium. It just occurred to me after 6 hours of walking.
Yeah.
I don't know why it took 6 hours. I'm one of the leads in the biggest ice show in the world.
Yeah.
There's a stadium here in the city.
Yeah.
And they're probably loading into the stadium. So I literally got a taxi cab to take me to the stadium. And as soon as I got to the stadium... Everybody was there. Like, the crew was setting up the show. And
but you had been... You got lost at night?
I got lost early in the day and was stuck in the city all day.
Oh, you got lost early in the day.
And was just wandering lost for 6 hours. Because every street looks the same in Europe. Like, in those cities, it's like...
So you might have started your adventure, like, at, 7 in the morning, 8
in the
morning?
No, not that. Like, it was more like 11 a.m. Okay.
Oh, and this was a night show. You're going, like, it was a 7 p.m. performance type thing.
Yeah, we didn't have a show that night. but they were setting up. The crew had already had all the trucks were setting up.
Okay,
so I showed up to the building in a taxi cab, and all the crew guys were like, why are you here?
Yeah.
You don't have to be here for two more days.
And I'm like, oh, for two more days.
Good story.
I'm a little bit early.
I don't know where I live.
Did they
helped me. Yeah, they helped you. And they helped me find my way back to the old lady's place. Yeah.
So at what point in your career, how many years into it had you been?
That was 2 years in.
That was 2 years.
Because the thing is, when you become an entertainer, you know, professional entertainer, traveling and touring, the first 6 months to a year, you're an idiot. You don't know. Because you have to learn the rules of the road and the way it works. You know, because, if you pass by a convenience store and there are little things that you might need, like deodorant, get it. Because you might run out in 3 days and you won't have access to that kind of a store for a week and a half.
Oh, wow.
So you've got to always be thinking stock up, little things like that. You know, it's your one day off. You need to do laundry. You better get to a laundromat.
So that was a couple years in. And then...
Yeah, so that was 2 years in.
That was 2 years in?
Yeah.
At that point...
That was my first major role in a big, big show.
First major role in a big, big show. Was that the first time you realized that... maybe I don't want to do this, or had you thought about
previously? I loved it.
Oh, you loved it?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, you getting lost in Germany.
Oh, that was a day of what am I doing?
I was scared. But then, say for instance, the next day or the day after, once you started skating again, you forgot about that, and then you're like, this is my life, this is my passion, so I'm going
on tour every day is a weird, crazy adventure. It's not like normal life, which is part of the addiction that makes it hard for you to leave that life.
Yeah.
You get sucked back in because you say...
Right.
Skaters... I mean, there's been skaters who have thrown themselves their own retirement party.
And then come back because they miss it.
Yeah, they're back in September.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's May. It's the end of the season.
Yeah.
They throw a big party. People bring them gifts.
Yeah.
And then come September, they are right back there on the bus. And if you take it seriously, you're completely 100% committed. So I totally get that. It's like this journey. And once you start that journey... You are like on track, and then the journey ends.
Yeah, and then what do you do?
And then there's that depression mode of, well, now what?
Yeah.
And generally, people cycle back to the beginning. And
okay. It's like, start back from scratch, but then there's some people that go into coaching. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Lots of people like you.
Yeah.
But okay, so what was the deciding? So you had some doubts here and there, but what was the straw that broke the camel's back, and you're like, I'm quitting show business and being professional, and I'm going to go move into Toronto and coach.
I was a really bizarre situation with a producer, and my partner and I were dumped, and I would say dumped, at one or two in the morning in downtown London, England.
Yeah.
With nowhere to stay. We were just dropped.
Like dropped, you mean like...
pulled over to the side of the road and left on the curb with our suitcases. Nowhere to stay.
Wait, you mean like literally?
Yeah. No plan of attack.
Why did they do that to you? What was the factor?
Contract was over.
No.
And we tried to negotiate with them, and it was a big long mess, but they basically just dumped us on the side of the road. And
no, but literally.
Yeah. But it was one of those, you're in the middle of it all and you're stressed out and you're just like, we'll figure it out when we get there.
But why didn't you go back to them and say, like, why didn't you renegotiate a contract?
There weren't the kind of people to deal with on that level.
Really?
It was a bad situation. It was just a very, very bad situation. It was a horrible.
So they weren't nice people to begin.
Horrendous situation.
Yeah.
Horrendous.
Does that happen a lot in the industry? Like just nasty people that don't.
Not like that. No.
No, okay, this was particularly
just,
bad.
Yeah. So they just dropped us there, and I remember us standing in the cold. It was a cold night, and we were at a train station, and it was just dead, because it was 1 in the morning. And the train station, it's not like in an airport where it's... So it was dead. And we stood there, and we're like, okay, what do we do? Do we just kind of hang out here for the next pretty much 10 hours? Do we just sit here on a park bench for 10 hours like homeless people? And we were tired. We just had 3 shows. We're exhausted. And so we were like, no, let's go find a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get in a room. We'll just crash on the beds and we'll sleep it, you know. And it was 1 in the morning. And I remember waking up, because we only had, you know, we remember waking up and being in a panic of where are we? Because we had wandered the streets at night. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know where we were.
Yeah.
We knew we were in London.
Yeah.
But as far as where we were exactly, we had no idea.
Oh, man.
Because we had been wandering up and down side streets from Paddington Station for an hour and a half. So we really had no idea logistically where we were. And we just gathered our, we quickly showered, gathered our stuff, and we went to the, and it was just, oh my God. And I remember us getting back into Paris and just being like, how did we fall into that situation?
Wow.
You know? And the worst part of the whole thing was we only took that job as a favor to that producer. Because we were flown in for a week.
Wow. And that same producer dumped you like that.
Yep. And so from that moment forward,
holy
I was just done.
Holy smokes.
And I remember sitting down with her and saying after that, I'm like, I remember us sitting in a cafe in Paris a day or two later, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I am too old for this shit.
Yeah.
And I am too old to be dealing with these kind of people. Done.
Yeah.
Uh-uh. No more. I am out of here, you know? And she was like, I totally understand, you know?
Your partner?
Yeah.
Is that who you have tattooed
on
your neck?
No.
No. This is another female single, like a doubles partner.
Yeah.
How long had you been working with her?
What's this?
This other partner. Like the partner that wandered through the streets with you. How long had you been partnered together?
We did about 5 years. 5 years. And did lots of TV shows.
Too.
It was just, it was so weird.
And then you told your partner, I've had enough, I'm leaving.
It wasn't not to do with her. She was
no,
awesome.
Yeah, she was awesome.
But I just couldn't keep up with the life.
Did she stay in the business? Is she still in the business?
Yeah.
What's her name? Can you name drop?
Yeah, Florentine.
Florentine?
Yeah. If you Google me, she's everywhere. She's awesome. But it was just one of those, I am done here.
Nicholas and Florentine. If I pull that up on Google, you'll pop up.
There's a million videos, yeah.
Oh, but I'm going to go check it out.
But yeah, so.
Wow, that'd be actually really cool.
Yeah, so, I don't know, but it was an interesting, but that's how it ended. I just like, I can't do this life anymore. I won't. It was just like, as certain as I could possibly be that I won't deal with these people anymore. I will not walk into this kind of a situation. I'm just too old. There comes a point in that kind of a life, lifestyle where you come to a crossroads of this is not acceptable and I won't, and that was the moment.
Not going to take it anymore.
Nope.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for you. And then you moved to Toronto? Toronto?
Yeah.
Did you know that people make fun of people from Toronto because we don't
say how we say it.
So what was that movie with was it Ben Affleck? Ben Affleck, and he plays like this. He's trying to get the U.S. Embassy people out of some country.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then, Argo.
Argo. And then he goes. What does he say to them? They're trying to practice who they are.
Right.
And this person reads the thing. Hi, my name is Betty Sue. I'm from Toronto. And then Ben Affleck's like, boom, you're dead. They don't pronounce the T.
Yeah.
It's Toronto.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you decided to move to Toronto, Ontario.
Yeah, and started coaching. And
the rest is kind of history.
Yeah.
Did you have to build up your client base? I'm sure, right?
Yeah, and that took some time.
Did people, like when you started coaching, did people say, oh, I want to work with him, he's a former professional? Did they know you enough to know? No, nobody knew you like that then.
No. Yeah.
So unless you were Kurt Browning, Elvis Stoico, top of the top, nobody really knew.
No, you're just starting, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because everything I had done in Europe was, as far as the fame, like all the TV shows, that was all in Europe. So I was nobody here.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Now if I coach there.
Oh, okay. So people that
big profile,
right.
That people are like, oh my God.
So why did you decide not to coach? I guess you couldn't work overseas. And
no, I had
a visa.
Paper. I had
okay,
visas, and
okay,
I'd gone through all that process because I had spent pretty much 15 years over there.
Then why did you not stay in Europe?
I could make more money here in Toronto.
Really?
Coaching.
No way.
Yeah.
Even though when you're over there, you're more recognizable.
Figure skating is much bigger.
Here.
Yeah.
Here. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a whole different, here in Canada, figure skating and hockey are big sports. Yeah.
You're coaching a little bit more hockey players, but you have other clients, obviously.
Yeah. I have figure skaters, but the majority of the work that I do is with hockey, and I like it. Because with hockey, you can see results instantly. Yeah, I can fix something in 20 minutes with a kid. You know, I just... Whereas with figure skating, I'd spend 3 months just to make the smallest...
The tiniest little incremental improvement.
Because figure skating... I compare figure skating more to golf. Those two sports are very similar because it's all technique. Mm-hmm. And it's a mental game of being able to put it together, especially under pressure. You know, it's not the kind of sport where you can just show up once a week and kind of just be amazing. Mm-hmm. You've really got to invest the time.
Hours and hours.
And that's just to be mediocre.
Yeah.
You know, and golf is the same way. Mm-hmm. You know? You could golf every single day of your life.
Yeah, and still be...
You're not going to be Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
You know, like there's... But it's and those two sports are very similar, even though they look completely different.
Yes.
What it takes you to be a Tiger Woods is the same thing that it takes you to be an Olympic champion in figure skating. It's the exact same. Mm. There's such a mental game because you have one opportunity in every competition. Yeah. You've got 3 minutes on that ice, and there's no start over. There's no give me 2 minutes to get my head together. It's like once they announce you.
That's it. You have three minutes.
Yeah, you're out there, and the door closes, and you're on that ice by yourself for that 3 minutes, and you got to lay it down.
So it's almost like you have to be like single-mindedly obsessive about figure skating for anybody that has aspirations of making it big.
Yeah, because in figure skating, if you miss a jump, it's very easy to, you know, your mindset has now changed. You fall on your ass in the first jump. You've got 3 minutes to recover immediately. You have to be able to focus your brain to pull it all back together to make sure the next jump is not missed or you don't screw it up. Mm-hmm. And that's the same with golf. Once that game starts, you screw up on a hole. You've got to pull yourself back together. You can't just let everything slide for the next, you know. So they're very similar in the sense of once that game begins, it's on, and you're on your own. It's not like a team sport where you can depend on other people to carry you through or, you know, I don't know. But, yeah.
So then you as a kid.
And I love that. As a coach, I love developing that because it's with hockey because I can change. It's edge skills and I can.
Yeah, you can say like oh, put your knee this way. I don't know what you do, and foot, instantly knee, he's so much better.
Instantly.
Okay. Or she so much better. So,
instantly. And it's exciting to watch. And sometimes I'll be recording with my phone.
Oh, cool. I use my phone a lot. Oh, cool. Because you can show like before and after.
Yes, within a 10-minute period. Yeah,
within 10 minutes, look what I did to this hockey kid.
Exactly.
And then, okay, oh, this is amazing testimonial, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Of course, then they leave and they come back, you know.
And bring their friends.
They'll fix it, but then they forget what they fixed.
Right, yes.
Because it's such an immediate fix.
Yeah.
They'll very quickly go back to what they were doing before. Mm-hmm. So it's really a constant... They've got to practice every week. They got to show up to practice with me every week so that we can make it consistent.
Right.
Because I can fix it immediately.
Exactly.
I don't know.
So you as a kid, how long did you put into your craft? Because you basically, you made it. You're a professional figure skater. You're working for Disney on Ice. You made it.
Yeah.
So you as a kid, that must have been like super driven and focused throughout your childhood. Like how long were your training sessions? What were you doing? And like how often and when did you start? And tell me that.
When I started with hockey at age 2.
Wow. What?
What do you mean
you started hockey?
I started skating at age 2. So basically, as soon as I could walk, I was skating. I was on the ice.
Whose decision was that? Because you can barely talk. So how can you say, like, put me in ice skates?
Well,
who put you in ice skates?
At the time, Wayne Gretzky was at the prime of his career. Because, like, I was born in 78. So, you know, Wayne Gretzky was just taking
kind
off.
Kind of like... Early 80s.
So everybody wanted their son to be Wayne Gretzky because he was like that new kid that was just emerging on the scene. So
you were going to be the next Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah,
they didn't put figure skates on you. They put hockey skates on you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But my parents both worked for, my dad worked for the police force and my mom worked for the RCMP. So they both, you know, they both worked shift work. So they didn't have time to take me to the rink. They took me once or twice, and I seemed to enjoy it, I guess, just standing on the ice. We lived across the street from a rink, but they didn't have time to take me, so like an outdoor rink in Don Mills. And so they would put me in the kitchen on the linoleum floor, and I would just skate back and forth on the plastic. Floor.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And okay. I destroyed the floor, but the floor was from the 70s.
Yeah.
And it was now outdated, so they knew. They were renting.
They didn't care. Okay.
They were renting, so they didn't care.
Yeah.
And also, they knew this
it was
kitchen
be replaced, yeah.
needs to be redone.
Yeah.
Because the styles are changing. It's now going into the 80s.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
When was you? Do you
so
remember?
So I would skate back and forth.
Yeah.
Through, you know, it was only like four or five. It was a small kitchen, 4 or 5 feet back and forth. But as a 2-year-old, you know, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, that's a big space.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that?
No.
Skating back? Oh, they tell you stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had pictures.
When was, you have pictures.
Yeah.
When was your first memory of
being on the ice?
Being on the ice with skates on and everything.
I don't know. I do have a flicker flash memory of being outdoors at that rink. And that would have been between 2 years old and 4 years old. There's like a moment, how bright the lights were. And just everyone flying by.
Yeah.
Like I have that, but that's it.
I remember.
It's like a blurry photograph I can kind of see in my mind, but I don't know.
Yeah, I've told you before that my mom put me in figure skating.
Yep.
So it's actually pretty funny. So I actually was one of those kids that wanted to play hockey. Wayne Gretzky was still big when I was a kid.
Yep.
I wanted to play hockey. And I had like the sailor outfit and I had the coach. That's I had the personal coach because my mom. And it wasn't even group coaching. It was one on one.
Do you have any pictures of this?
I do. I'll send you some. You know what I'll do?
You're in a sailor
suit. You know what I'll do with this?
That's
with this?
Funny.
You know what I'll do with this episode? I think would be amazing. On social media when I announce this episode,
yeah.
I'll post maybe like on a Tuesday or something. Yeah. What is it? No, Thursday. Throwback Thursday, and I post a picture of me. Oh, I did a great interview with Nicholas.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I used to be a figure skater, you know, I think that would be a cool lead up, right?
Yeah. So when I went from the hockey,
sorry, continue. So, totally off.
I'm just gonna just so we round that out.
Yeah.
So I started in hockey, and I got my dad was a coach, and he was very young, and as a dad, very immature. Like he would yell and scream and curse, and I was a 4-year-old, 5-year-old on the team, and he would be screaming and yelling obscenities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he would, you know, got fired from volunteer coaching positions. So I found figure skating at the rink, and I knew instantly he wouldn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
I just kept on. I was like, I want to do that. And I only want, and it, the biggest thing was to get away from having to deal with him.
Oh, wow. When,
the crazy
when did you make that decision?
I was 7.
You were 7, and
I didn't know what figure skating was, but I saw that you didn't have to wear equipment. You were by yourself out there. And I could tell, trying to talk to him about it, that he wanted nothing to do with it.
So who did you approach your mother?
Mom, yeah.
Okay, you approached mom.
And so they agreed after a year of saying no, no, no.
1 year it took. Yeah. 1 year of begging.
Because, yeah, but I also went into the hockey dressing room as a 6-year-old, I guess.
Yeah.
And spent that whole year talking to all the other boys on the team. We should join figure skating. At the age of 7, I did both hockey and figure skating.
Okay, and hockey and figure skating.
My dad and them saw it was Wayne Gretzky also did figure skating.
So they could justify it. Okay, so it was like a transitionary period, and maybe he's going to come back to hockey.
Yeah, that was the whole plan from their point of view.
Oh, so they want to make you a better skater.
But as soon as I got into figure skating, I entered a competition, and I won.
And then you were hooked.
And then it was just like, how do you tell a kid that just won a competition, no, you can't do this anymore, you know? So it just kind of took off from there, and
and you're about 8 or 9 years old when you won. Like,
7.
You're seven. Oh, so when you did your first year of figure skating when you're 7.
7.
And you won your first.
A couple months in.
A couple months in.
Yeah,
You're a natural.
Yeah, because I had been skating since I was 2, so I had the basic skating skills. I could already skate forward and backwards.
Forward and backwards. Do the turn and stop.
I could all do that.
Okay,
kind of stuff.
Which kids when they're 7 years old typically can't even stop.
I was already there, so it was just a matter of now learning tricks, jumps and spins.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then it led to pair skating. I became a pair skater, and then went to nationals and Canadian championships. And
so when you became a professional, did people approach you, or you had to go out and give people your resume and say, this is what I've done,
yeah,
is how great I am, I've won these competitions, you should look at my tapes?
That's That's an interesting thing.
Because they didn't have like YouTube, so they couldn't. Right. You couldn't say, "Look at my look at my YouTube page or whatever." Right. So how do people?
That's how they do it now. It's all YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah.
But at the time, well, first of all, when you come into the amateur world of figure skating, that competitive, even if you've been to internationals and nationals, and you're like you're really freaking amazing, you have no understanding of the professional world of show skating. That whole Disney on Ice, all of that ice show stuff, you don't understand. It's a whole different world. Two different worlds. They're run by different people, different set of rules. It's all not connected in any way. So you have no understanding of how the business end of it works. Because when you retire and you go into show skating, you're now kind of a company. You're self-employed and you're being hired out on contracts. So you have a career now to manage that involves contract negotiations of who you're going to work for and what you're going to make and all that kind of stuff. And where you're going to go and what jobs can you find.
Yeah.
All of these things are on you to find.
Sorry, did you say you had an agent?
Like, no, there's no such thing really as skating agents. Really? Unless you're at the Olympic level and you're making big money.
Wow, so you had to hustle all yourself.
Yes, the hustle is completely on you.
Oh, wow.
And you're completely on your own when shit goes sideways. There's nobody to kind of protect you or take care of you or, you know.
Just like the producer that dropped you on the side of the road.
Yep. You're just like, fuck, how did this happen? How did I end up in this mess?
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, but you don't know any of that stuff. And that's in the book that I wrote, I really had to focus the first book because it's a series. There's three books in the series. The first book really had to be about explaining all of those things you would not know unless you were in the industry. And it's all the things that
yes,
I learned.
Right, because I have no... This is a completely different... This is new. This is all new to me.
Yeah.
I have no idea
that
this world even exists and how it's created and functions and how dark it can be. Wow.
Yeah, and when I wrote this, I didn't... That wasn't my first intention. I was just going to write stories and write it the way I wanted to tell it, but I couldn't do that until I explained certain important things about making that transition.
Yeah.
And learning the, you know, and so I made the first book about just this girl and her friend. The two of them both show up. They're both 18. They show up. They don't know each other until they get there and they become roommates.
So this friend in the book, is this actually a friend that you had met as well?
No.
Okay. So this is a fictional friend.
They're both fiction.
Okay. Yeah.
Even though the main character is predominantly autobiographical, like it's me.
Right, okay.
But I've put into the framework of...
Okay,
of
to make it work. Okay.
To make it work for the audience.
Yeah.
Everything that they experience in this first book is really everything I experienced in the first 2 years, first year at least, of show skating.
Mm-hmm.
Just not knowing anything, how do I survive in this business? How do I get jobs?
Mm-hmm.
How do I, you know, how does all of this work? You know, and everything that you would not know until you were there and showed up, and nobody really wants to be your friend in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason the book is called The New Girls is because nobody wants to learn your name
because
you're new.
Wow.
And the thing is, not only they don't really want to get to know the new person because A, all you're going to do is ask stupid questions.
Mm-hmm.
B, they're then you're gonna look at them like they're responsible for taking care of
you. Right, right. When you get lost in Germany.
Yeah. As that new kid.
Yeah, you're on your own, new kid.
You're on your own, and everyone kind of refers to you for the first couple of weeks as the new boy or the new girl.
Yeah.
And it's not because people can't remember your name, it's because they don't give a fuck.
Oh, so that's why it's called the new girl.
Yeah, because I was like, for the first couple of weeks, nobody fucking cares what your name is. Because you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And we know it. And we've all been that person. Every person on tour has been that know nothing. What am I doing here? How do I survive here? How do I make a life work in this strange environment? Where do I go? Where do I sit on the bus? What's the difference? You know, there's two buses traveling to the same city. One's the loud bus and one's the quiet bus.
Mm.
If you want to sleep, you go on the quiet bus.
Right.
If you want to socialize and party, you go on the loud bus. Pick which bus you want to go on. Like, nobody explains that stuff to you.
Right.
It's kind of like you're just like, you're standing at the buses going, there's two buses.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
Is there a difference?
One's a sleeping bus, one's a party bus.
Yeah, and nobody tells you these things. There's nobody holding your hand and explaining to you.
So sometimes you might have gotten on the party bus and just thought that that's what... Oh, and you just didn't know. So you thought skating was just this party.
Nothing is explained.
Oh, okay.
It's not like... Yeah, there's nobody... when you show up at that airport, on the other end, there's nobody there holding your hand and kind of teaching you the ropes. It's you figuring it out on your own. And a lot of times you're partnered up with another new person so you can learn together and figure it out. And you have somebody that you can kind of connect with and feel lost with. And the other reason they put you on your own with that other person is nobody wants to room with you. Because you're going to then be trying to make them responsible for taking care of you.
Okay, so that's why it's called the new girls.
That's why it's called the new girls. Because the two new girls.
Okay, so there's two of them.
Yeah. And
that's cool.
Kind of figuring it out for themselves.
Oh, okay.
So if anyone wants to go into the ice show industry and you want to know what it's like, read this book. Because this book will give you all the answers that you need to know before you show up.
Wow.
In the amateur world, everything's about training and winning. In the show world, it's about... just get to the building on time, make sure your shit is together, make sure your costumes are preset, unzipped. The competitive route has to come obviously before the show route because you got to get good before you can go into the shows or you're not going to get hired, right? But the competitive route is all training. You're waking up at 5 a.m. every morning.
Okay, yeah.
And you're so focused and you're so structured and you're also under the direction of a coach.
Yeah.
And if you're any good, you've got a coaching staff.
Yeah.
You've got a whole team around you. As a pair skater, I had a jump coach, a spin coach, a throw and lift. Like you had different coaches for different things that you would do. Like this is the coach that's going to focus on your pair spins, on your this, on your that. This coach is going to focus on your lifts and your twists and your, everything's very structured. And so you have this team around you. And in the show world, you have nothing around you. You have no structure. Life has no structure because you're floating from hotel to hotel.
Right.
And you're really on your own to make sure you get to the building. Or and if the company's sending transportation, a bus to take you from the hotel to the venue, you better be on that bus. It's not going to wait for you. And if you miss it, you're in a lot of trouble.
You've written a book.
Yeah, it's called The New Girls.
The book is called The New Girls by Nicholas Keegan.
Yeah.
And
you can get it anywhere.
Amazon, you can get anywhere.
Barnes & Noble, Chapters.
Chapters? Okay. Yeah. So I went to Chapters right now, and I would see you on the bookshelf.
Type it in the computer. Yeah.
Get out of here. This is so cool, man.
Yep. It's all good.
I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Was there anything else?
No. Okay. I think we covered it all. All right.
That's good.
All right.
All right. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Nick. And thank you very much, my man.
All right. Thank you.
Cool.
All right. Bye.
Cool.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to Biceps and Banter with Brandon Crow. If you like our show, do us a huge subscribe, toss a review on iTunes, or maybe share the show with your friends. And if you want to know more, find us at fastingftw.com. Our Patreon is patreon.com/fastingftw. Thank you.